the skilled workforce. But then on the other side of the issue, what you're looking at as an employer, you're looking at your labor costs, what they are, the product you're selling, and having to increase the price of your product that you're selling, and then you're competing with the other markets, you know. But I think that, you know, you can't, if we're going to be apples and apples, then that's the way it is. We can't talk apples and oranges in some cases. So, I'm willing to listen and discuss it, but I don't know if it's going to be the same for one industry, and we're looking across it, then I'm having a little bit of a problem with it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may just interject, I noticed that the agricultural workers in the Matsu Valley are exempt.
Well, I'm not saying that I'm going to support them. I said I'm just listening to the arguments on it.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Furtis?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when we initially looked at this legislation, one of the rationale for introduction was looking at those industries that were principally hazardous. We talked about asbestos workers and the problems of being on a respirator for extended periods of time. And it was somewhat my understanding that in drafting the legislation, we would be targeting those kinds of industries as opposed to doing sort of a blanket change that would cover, in fact, all industries that were not specifically exempted under the legislation. And so with that, I do have some concern. I want to call up a comment to Mr. Carr's statement. We well recognize that in the fishing industry, there are a number of young people out there that are working, and oftentimes they're in a fairly captive environment, being out at a fish camp or whatever. And we do indeed find probably abuses that need some oversight. And one of the punishments, if you work that person for an extended period of time, you should be made to pay. And if there's any industry that probably needs the protection of this type of legislation, I'd say it would be the fishing industry. Granted, it's a hardship, but then the hardships that imposed upon the fishing industry are the same one that would be imposed upon any other industry that comes under the legislation. So,
well, if you stop and think about it, this only applies to people who are worked over 12 hours a day. Even if you work somebody 24 hours in the day, since it's only additional half more pay, we'd be talking about paying them for those extra, for every two extra hours they work, paying them one additional hour of pay. So for every six additional hours you work, you're only talking about paying an extra 3 hours of pay. I mean, it's not much money for working somebody 24 hours a day. Representative Davidson?
It's probably difficult to realize how this thing operates as far as the fishing industry is concerned. We have, in some instances, we have fisheries that are open 12 to 24 hours a day, and they're closed for 3 months, 6 months, whatever. Now, you're never going to get a steady workforce to take a job that says, well, geez, yeah, you come to work, and we'll give you 2 days' work. If I'm a cannery worker, and I can work, and fishermen will go out and fish for 48 hours at a time, and that's the way it operates for the cannery worker, too. When the work is there, that's when you get it. And the choice is going to be having the work there or not having the work there. So, again, I just want to emphasize, it's true, some of the problems within the fishing industry are the very ones that we want to correct, but you correct them at the demise of the industry. And it's a difficult thing to judge, but that's just the way it is.
Maybe I could ask the witness, does exemption number 9 on page 2, employed as a seaman, are fishermen covered under the existing overtime law?
Fishermen are exempt.
So we're not talking about fishermen at all?
Fish processors are not exempt. Fishermen.
So people out on boats are exempt, so they're not an issue before us at all. Are there further questions for the witness, Representative Ellis?
Just a question for Representative Davidson. You're saying if this bill became law in its current form, that the canneries wouldn't hire anyone, they would just go out of business?
I think a lot of them would. The choice for the industry, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is going to be, well, okay, if we're going to be forced to pay double time, then what we'll do is we'll just lower the wage initially. And that's what you'll see. So
in some instances, you might even see this as lowering the regular rate of pay, because that's what the response would have to be by someone who has to take into consideration what his cost of labor would be.
Why wouldn't you hire more people?
Well, for one thing, in Kodiak, you wouldn't have the people there to hire. I mean, you could get a job right now at Kodiak if you wanted it. It's just the nature of the industry.
Well,
in the summer.
But do you know what the standard wage for the fish processing people are?
It varies from the minimum wage up to $6-7 an hour.
So it certainly wouldn't impact. It wouldn't be a decrease in wages for people who work in the minimum wage.
No, but there'll be a lot of people in the summertime, you know, college kids and that, who would be impacted by that.
And do you know what the average hours work? I mean, how many people do they work over 12 hours a day?
Well, they're probably, it depends on the fish. That's what I'm trying to say, is that it depends on the length of the season and how much fish comes in during that opening of that season. And it's a very unpredictable thing, and there's no way that there's no way you can say, well, this is what the way it will be, because invariably, well, there are simply too many variables. You cannot get a handle on it.
Representative,
Mr. Chairman, I somewhat concur with the gentleman from Kodiak. However, the same thing exists, as I understand, in the oil field development. For example, you work a person, 24 on and 24 off or whatever, but oftentimes you'll find a person is on duty, available for work, but maybe not be working because whatever they're designed to do or there to do, that activity may not be scheduled at that particular time. So they may be there, they may exceed the time and go into the overtime category, but simply hasn't done any physical labor, but was there on a standby, therefore they're to be paid and they're subject to the overtime. So you have the situation there. I guess what I'd like to see us go back and, again, as I originally understood it, target those areas that were of hazards, dealing with asbestos, hazardous substance or whatever, and then make some, if we're going to do this, let's target those kinds of considerations rather than industries that does not pose at least a hazard, a physical hazard to the person. And it probably makes more sense, but change the rule on the general industry to include canneries seems to be a little bit much at this time, and that would be my suggestion.
Okay. I think it's a good discussion. I think it might be something we'd want to exempt is the standby employees, not go to a double time for standby. That'd certainly be easy enough to draft into this. I still think that if we back up and think about what we're dealing with here, for those, we're only dealing with the 12 hours after 12 hours in a 24-hour day, and the potential for the additional cost is pretty minimal for even if it was a 24-hour, but if somebody's on standby status, I think that might be a good exception to this. Representative Bernard.
I just have some questions, and maybe someone from the oil industry or someone on it. I understand some of the folks in my district and from the various districts I commute will go to the slope and work 7-12, and then they're off 7 days. Mm-hmm. So on that 7th day, that would be strictly a double time day, in other words, mm-hmm. on that, which have an impact on that. But then, Representative Davis, one of the other things I think we talked about when we introduced this legislation was the effect of our workman comp problems when you're working people beyond 12 hours in our fish processors, when you're working around machinery and all that stuff. Some of them might come up with short-handed and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, so those are some of the other concerns that we're looking at too. You know, that impact our things. So I think there is a balance of things to look at. But the other thing on the there are other companies that work 7-12s where they're on a week and off a week, and which is going to definitely impact them on those on that side too. But I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I think there is some good discussions here, but I think we're going to have to.
All right. Is there further questions for this witness? We have one other person to testify, Simon.
I have one other question for the committee to consider. There are always ways to get around any of these overtime laws. And the close scrutiny doesn't necessarily point it out, but in 12 years of enforcement, I've seen some of the trickier ways that employers can deal with this. And if one of the committee's concerns is ensuring that by putting that 12-hour cap, that they're perhaps eliminating a more hazardous circumstance when employees work longer hours, there are certainly easy ways to work beyond 12 hours if this law were to pass as written without incurring an overtime or double time liability. For example, we work in auditing purposes with a work week and a work day. A work day is 24 hours. And the law says anyone who works more than 8 hours in a work day, this law passes, 12 hours in a work day must be paid double time. Work day, if not established by the employer, is used for other purposes, a calendar day from midnight to midnight. An employer can schedule a shift to start at noon, work until midnight, work until 8 o'clock the next morning, having worked 20 hours straight through, and there would be no double time because they're working those 20 hours on two separate work days. So that's a consideration you might want to look at if you're really concerned with the safety hazard.
But if they were to keep maintain that shift, I mean, they'd
work
carry
shift
over.
Continually, it would carry over, yes.
Right. And then I think there's federal labor law prohibits an employer from changing a work week more than once to avoid overtime. I think if you can show the case law, the federal case law indicates that. If you go changing your work week every other week to avoid paying overtime, you're in trouble. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Tangent?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is J.P. Tangent. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce in the place of Mr. Cruz, who couldn't make it today. The State Chamber of Commerce is opposed to the passage of HB 436 because of its potentially damaging effects. Specifically, we're concerned about the double time provision. We think that at this stage of Alaska's economic development, the state government should be doing everything possible to encourage business development, and we feel that this legislation would have the opposite effect. It has been estimated by one of the state's larger resource corporations that passage of the double time provision of HB 436 would cost them about $13.5 million a year.
Which one was that?
I did not prepare the testimony, and I don't have the answer to that question, but I'd be happy to provide this information to you, sir, if you'd like. From what I gather, though, this company has invested billions of dollars in Alaska and plans for greater development, which in turn would be good for the economy.
The other thing I'd be interested in is that assumption based on passage of a flex work week or not.
I don't,
because they're going to be having to pay time and a half anyhow for all that time. If they want a flex work week, that isn't in existing law.
That's correct.
So I would hope those numbers were based on existing law and not an anticipated change in law.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Another company, which is referred to here again, I don't have the identification of the company, which is identified simply as the North Slope Support Company, estimates that passage of HB 436 would increase their costs $340,000 annually. This is described as a firm which has successfully survived a severe cutback in the field on work during the past 2 years and which is geared up for future expansion. This legislation, if passed, HB 436 if passed, would send a message from the state saying that basically we're not interested in seeing companies along that line survive. We think that basically, the State Chamber of Commerce is in the position that this is the wrong time to be contemplating legislation of this sort. And we would urge that consideration be deferred or the bill be held in committee.
Questions for Mr. Tangent? I have a couple questions. Number one, how many hours does the State Chamber believe are too many hours in a day for an individual to work?
I don't think we've had any position along that line. The question, I think, is not the number of hours in the day. The question is more of the cost of employment.
Well, my question is based on safety. At what point, how many hours in the day does the safety of the worker start to decrease in a situation?
I don't have any evidence.
Well, without that evidence, don't you think you're missing one of the big factors in dealing with the work day hours? I mean, if you don't have any evidence about that, don't you think that's an appropriate criteria for the state to determine wage and hour?
I didn't understand this to be health and safety legislation. I understood this to be our wage and hour legislation, which is, I regard as somewhat different, on a different point. I think obviously the health and safety of the workers is a critical factor in any context, and that in some situations it may not be appropriate for a person in a hazardous industry such as those Mr. Furness referred to, I think, to be working nearly so long as in other instances where they're charged with being with actual work, but they're in fact on a standby situation. So I don't think there's a direct answer to that question.
Okay. Do you think there's any point of time then where too many hours results in a loss of safety on the job?
Not the person standing by for 24 hours, I think, no. If the person is exposed to hazardous toxic substances or something like that, yes, I suppose there is, depending on the facts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. JP, I would be interested in the stats that are there where the one company said 13 and a half million or something and the other one said 400 and some thousand.
Just simply different companies that were so bold.
I know, but if for the committee, if we had some backup saying some specifics that this is the way they work, they're working 7-12s, and this is, you know, what we're on, and this is where we come up with the number. So, and especially the 13 and a half million. So we would have a little more backup, I think it would be helpful. Because I think we can.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tangent, my question is, it seems that there are many variables as we consider who should or could or would not or could not pay this so-called added cost, as the discussion states. But does the Chamber, in fact, consider or make those considerations when they, it sounds to me like the Chamber just wants to say, well, geez, anything that costs more money to do business is bad for the state because it sends a message from the state. And I guess my concern is, but are there not considerations where, depending on one, it may be that the company, instead of sending people up for 7 days a week, can say a work week is 6 days, so that they don't have to pay that extra overtime in that seventh day. The place where I'm having a problem with this legislation is that I have a time constraint, both as the product comes in and as the product is processed. So that's quite different from, I mean, it's a lot different dealing with a kettle of fish than it is a barrel of oil, for example. And so my question then is, do you take these kinds of considerations into mind when you make these kinds of comments? Or are you just saying it's a...
I think the primary thrust of this testimony from Mr. Davidson is specifically to the economic impact on the... companies involved, and it's specifically in the context of the economic situation in Alaska as it stands right now. I think that to the extent that we have companies that are contemplating closing down and moving out of the state for economic reasons, in any case, if they're confronted with additional economic burdens as a result of legislation passed by the legislature, then it simply adds to the justification for closing down. I mean, you know, it's the same argument you made with a few moments ago with regard to the fishery. There's alternatives, and there's alternative places to do business when you're dealing with commodities which are found elsewhere. And so you just simply try to create an economic climate which makes it easier for companies to continue to do business here if possible.
Mr. Tangent, if we're going to amend our wage and hour laws or look on that as an impact upon our wage and hour laws, What's the line? What line do we draw there? Is what I'm interested in. Do you think time and a half is too much?
Well, I think the...
Does the Chamber support the existing law, in other words? Do you think time and a half is too much?
The Chamber's published position with regard to overtime law, as I recall it, is to make flex time possible. And so therefore, I think that it depends a little bit on the needs and the circumstances of the industry. I think that the federal statute, which basically provides for time and a half over 40 hours, is the law that we're currently looking at is the most desirable objective at this point.
So you see no problem with working people 100 hours a week?
Well, it depends on the facts and circumstances. It depends specifically on where they're working and what they're called upon to do. The standby situation is a case in point where 100 hours a week is probably it doesn't jeopardize the health and safety of the work on the one hand, and it's not irrational to pay them for under the federal law on the other.
Okay, well, let's remove that condition. Let's say that there's an exemption for standby workers.
Okay.
Where does that leave us?
Again, the standby worker is an illustration. It's not necessarily an exclusive list. The circumstance which Representative Davidson referred to, in which you have a fisheries situation, is another example. And I suspect that one could prepare a fairly long list of examples in which it did not necessarily represent a dangerous proposition on the one hand, or an unfair proposition on the other, an unfair labor standard.
The only other question I have is I would like the chamber to provide the names and the backup data for the employers that were mentioned in your testimony.
I like that request.
And I would like a detailed analysis provided on those, saying what were the assumptions made when they made those estimates, whether the assumptions were based on not what were the costs of hiring an additional individual to work the 6 days and 12 hours versus not hiring them. I think that's the key. Okay. Are there further questions for the witness? Then, is there any other member of the public here to testify on this particular piece of legislation? Well, is there further committee discussion? We're going to hold this bill over and continue to work on it and have some more public testimony on it. Okay. Is there any further matters to come before the committee today? 433 West
43.
Oh. With the committee, if you've had a chance to take a look at the committee section for 433, we could. Have we adopted this yet?
We have not adopted that at the point.
I move to adopt committee substitute for HB 433.
Okay. Is there any objection to the new committee adopting a new proposed committee substitute for House Bill 433?
Mr. Chairman,
who's that first?
Review this. The only changes in the title, is that correct?
No. On House Bill 433, there are two changes. In the definition section on the last page of the bill, the word residential was put before the word vessel. And the drafter said it was not necessary to put the word residential in the title because that's already taken
that
care
is
of.
The only change.
The other change is that under the previous committee substitute, the court was left to determine what a fair rental value was for that you have to pay during the moratorium period. The court system told me that since they have no mechanism for determining a fair rental value, they'd have to go through an assessor. The fiscal note was potentially up to $2 million on this bill as a result of that. As a result of that, there's a section in this CS that determines that the fair rental value shall be what it takes to pay all taxes, condo association dues, maintenance, etc., and shall be not less than 50% of a monthly mortgage payment.
That's fair. I'll buy.
Okay. Motion to adopt the committee substitute. Any objection? Seeing no objection, committee substitute's adopted. What's the thinking of the members on this? Do we want to keep this in the committee and work on it more, or do we want to move it? Or? Judiciary, I think. Judiciary, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Davidson.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that JERC subcommittee on housing and banking was taking a look at this legislation. Has that committee, do you serve on that committee?
Yes.
Right? Are you finished looking at that?
Well, the situation is that committee is going to keep working until the bitter end. And what they've told us to do is not hold up legislation based on that committee, because it's got to go to the judiciary and then it's got to go to finance. And for us to proceed at our own speed on this and not wait for them.
Then I might ask, if I may, is there any other work that we think would that needs to be done on this so that
that would give judiciary less work to do on the bill so that we could get it through there faster.
Well, it's really hard for me to predict that.
But, were there but other areas that the subcommittee was talking about?
No, it's getting in pretty good shape now. It's an improvement over what we started with, and I think it's in pretty good, it's in good enough shape that I feel fairly good about sending it to judiciary. I'm also willing to keep it here and work on it some more if anybody has a particular suggestion.
Mr. Chairman, just philosophical, this is the one opportunity, this piece of legislation as I see it here, put this thing where it should be in the private sector, in the hands of the banking community and the courts. In other words, it says, you work it out. And I understand the feeling of not wanting to, quote, bail out, but bail out simply to me means using state dollars. If the court and the banks have to sit down and work this thing out, I think we'll see a lot less of the pressure that we're under right now. In other words, we are trying to move in such a direction that the state gets involved in the foreclosures of commercial property. And of course, residential property is a real nice thing. Commercial property is kind of a no-no. While I think the state doesn't have any business spending state dollars in what's termed a bailout, but the state has a responsibility in protecting the credit line. I think that this downward spiral can't simply be simplified in the area, and they're finding that out on the banking of commercial properties and residential properties. I think it's properly, and Mr. Cuddy gave me that indication when they were testifying the other day. We need to get the banks to sit down and with the people and have an opportunity to come to grips with it. And by moving that time back, we say, hey, you're going to have to sit down and work this thing out. And that's the main thing that most people need right now is time to work the problem out. You've got one economist saying it's going up, the next economist saying it's going down, and as far as I'm concerned, you stuff all the economists together and they equal plus and minus zero. There are some very bright signs. Industry indicates that exploration is going to be expanded. Just that type of thing. I think we need more of the emphasis on the positive. What I would like to do is get these people over here in the arena and let the banks and the people work it out, and the courts say, hey, you have to do it, and we can get on with doing what we can do in the various committees here. I like to call them the jerk committees, because, the Joint Economic Recovery, because that's what there's a lot of doing. There's a lot of jerking around going on here, and not an awful lot getting done. So I guess in answer to your question, if I thought that was going to stay in here and deal with the bigger picture, fine. I would say let's work on it. If that is impossible within this committee, well then let it go over to the next committee and I can speak and see what I can do to get something moving over there. So I don't, do you feel that we can encompass this, or is it the commercial property?
I like the way it's looking now. I think it's looking pretty good. I think it's probably time to send it to judiciary, but what I'm saying is I'm not asking for that. I just want to know how you all feel.
Well, how do you feel about that? Excuse me, Mr. the Chairman.
Well, we've accomplished, I think, the task that was set out the initial intent by confining it to residential properties to include the vessels. It seems to be about the limit we can adequately consider. The other idea would be to bring in a similar bill, almost exact language, but dealing with commercial.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine.
With that in mind, I'm not sure that anything else that this committee can do at this time.
Move out with individual recommendation. Go ahead.
I was just. Any objection?
No.
Okay, hearing no objection, the bill passes out of committee.
Okay, let's work on that.
I think
that.
That's it.
Don't go up to the
sides. Okay, I just asked that you. Stamp a break and sign the bill. All right, meeting's adjourned.
Representative Coulter?